Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
People Fixing the World is the podcast looking for solutions to the problems we face today.
It could potentially ease the suffering of millions.
We have a solution. Let's do it.
People Fixing the World from the BBC World Service.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Andrew Peach, and in the early hours of Monday, the 1st of April, these are our main stories. President Erdogan's AK party has suffered its biggest ever defeat in municipal elections in Turkey. As major protests take place in Jerusalem, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said he'll do everything in his power to get hostages in Gaza home. Also in this podcast, we hear from people in the Ukrainian city of Kharkiv who live in fear of a new Russian advance. And
I came back full of confidence, so inspired to give back to the community that I became a charity worker, and it's all thanks to the Homeless World Cup.
How football's Homeless World Cup is changing lives. Let's begin the podcast in Turkey. Now, as we record this edition, supporters of the main opposition party are out on the streets, waving flags and banners in Istanbul, celebrating a strong showing in local elections. With most of the ballots now counted, the party has already declared victory in both the country's biggest cities, Istanbul and Ankara. There's particular focus on Istanbul, whose mayor is seen as the best-placed opposition candidate for the next presidential poll in 4 years' time. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has acknowledged the election didn't achieve the desired results. Onur Erim from BBC Turkish gave me the latest.
Right now, more than 80% of the votes have been counted, and the main opposition party, CHP, is leading. They have control of the major cities in Turkey, and for the first time in the century, they control more cities and municipalities than the government party.
And this is a pretty significant defeat for President Erdogan. We've been hearing from him in the last few minutes.
Yes, he just spoke and he said this wasn't the result we wanted. But he also said this is not an end for our party, but a turning point. And he said Turkish voters have warned us and they will listen to the warning.
How much does it actually change? What's the significance of these particular election results?
It is a big morale boost to the opposition because they lost the general election and presidential elections last year. And although that was an alliance of opposition parties, this time the main opposition party, CHP, entered the elections by their own and they managed to increase the number of votes and they more than doubled the municipalities that they are ruling now.
The economy being difficult in Turkey at the moment, that's often such a driving force when it comes to people choosing how to vote in elections. Is that what's behind what's happened in the Turkish cities?
Yes, especially in the big cities, the cost of living crisis is felt more because of higher rents and higher food prices. So it had a big impact. In the rural areas, the government party, Mr. Erdogan's party, still has more vote. And we have also heard from Ekrem İmamoğlu, Istanbul's mayor, who tonight won his second term. He said, this is not only an important night for Istanbul, but also the democracies in the Western world. He was telling that the authoritarian tendencies in the last decade has extended a lot. And today, Turkey showed that things can be changed in a democratic way, although there is an authoritarian regime in the country.
Onur Erim from BBC Turkish. My colleague Owen Bennett-Jones has been getting reaction to the results from Rumeysa Kadak, an MP from the governing AK party in Istanbul.
We do respect the will of the people. We receive the message from the people and we will be doing our internal discussions. We need to work harder and harder and we need to make sure that we reach out to more people.
What do you think has gone wrong for the president? Because, you know, this is quite a result.
Well, local elections have their own dynamics. So this is very early, still very, very early to speculate. What we can say, we will have our internal discussions.
Right. I mean, well, there are some obvious ideas that could be out there. Inflation, is it 65, 70%?
It's too early at this point to make a conclusion about the reasons behind that.
I see.
We need to work harder for people because we have done a lot for the people of Istanbul and the people of Turkey. Maybe we need to reach out to more people and tell our message of unity and what we have done for them. Whatever people decide, this is the nature of democracy. You can't always win. So this just shows that we have a very vibrant democracy and we should just respect the will of the people. That's what I know as an MP in Istanbul.
Ramesa Kadak, an MP from the governing AK party in Turkey. Next to Israel, where the Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has given his first news conference in over a month. It comes as Israel continues its strikes against Hamas targets, including one near a hospital in central Gaza, in which four people are confirmed to have been killed. Mr. Netanyahu said the Israeli military was continuing its preparations for an assault on the southern city of Rafah, and he maintained he was doing everything he could to secure the release of the 130 or so Israeli hostages who remain captives of Hamas.
As the Prime Minister of Israel, I will do everything in my power to bring our beloved people home. Our efforts to get those hostages back are continuing all the time. Whenever we get intelligence, we put our heroic fighters in danger in order to do that. And we have had some success, but getting them back is a combination of negotiation and military force. And it has already enabled us to get back almost half the hostages.
Mr. Netanyahu was scheduled to undergo surgery for a hernia late on Sunday. I spoke to the BBC's Middle East Bureau Chief Joe Floto and began by asking Joe why Mr. Netanyahu had decided to give a news conference now.
He was there to deliver some reassurance and some warning. So the reassurance was that he was alive and well and vigorously in charge of his government just before he hands over the reins to his deputy while he goes under the knife tonight. And the other reassurance was to those protesters, and thousands of them are gathered in Jerusalem this evening, who want him to step down because the hostages aren't being released. So he was very clear to say we're doing everything we can, but it has been 4 months since the last truce managed to secure the release of hostages, and very little has been seen since. So the warnings were to those protesters, I think, that if they're calling for elections, that would play into Hamas's hands. And another warning that he is still very much planning on a military assault of the southern town of Rafah.
Yes, he came under quite a bit of pressure over Rafah from journalists asking questions, because I guess the point is they keep talking about an assault on Rafah, but it never happens.
He has been talking about it for weeks now, and one of his war cabinet colleagues had even said that if there wasn't a deal and if the hostages weren't released before the start of Ramadan, which started 2 weeks ago, then the assault would begin. However, the United States, Israel's strongest ally, has been very, very clear that an assault, a full-scale assault on Rafah, which is a small town swollen by around 1 million people who've been displaced from other parts of Gaza, that would be unacceptable because of the casualties and the misery that would reap upon all those displaced civilians. So they've been suggesting that there are other options and really been very vocal in telling the Israeli government they shouldn't consider that. And that not only the United States, but other European countries as well have voiced their concerns. And the United Nations had said it would be a catastrophe. But tonight, Netanyahu was saying again that this is what he needs to do in order to defeat Hamas, and that is the point of this war, after all, is to make sure that Hamas are never in a position to strike Israel again.
In terms of Benjamin Netanyahu's own health, he's not a young man. What more details have we been given about this hernia operation he's due to undergo?
Very little. He's not a young man, you're right. He's 74 years old, and last year everyone was quite surprised to hear that he'd undergone a sort of cardiac operation to install a pacemaker in his heart. Today's announcement, very much low-key. It's a routine operation. It is a hernia. It's something that millions of people undergo all the time. But he was very keen to be seen before he hands over the reins. In his own words, to quell some of the ridiculous rumours that came out last time that he was ill.
Joe Floto with me from Jerusalem. Romania and Bulgaria have become the newest members of Europe's Schengen area of free movement, but only for air and sea crossings. These travellers at Bulgaria's Sofia Airport on Sunday morning were pleased about the lifting of restrictions.
It's extraordinary. What can I say? It's a special feeling. I took out my passport for nothing. It's nice to feel like a European citizen.
It's very easy now at the borders. I have no problems at all.
Land border controls will remain in place because of Austria's opposition to the Eastern European nations becoming full members of the zone. Here's our Central Europe correspondent, Nick Thorpe.
Schengen has long been a magic word in Romania and Bulgaria, the goal of countless governments and the frustration of countless citizens. This morning, something changed. Passengers landing at any Romanian or Bulgarian airport from 27 Schengen countries will not face passport checks. Citizens from the rest of the world can apply for a Schengen visa at the Bulgarian or Romanian embassies, valid for all Schengen member countries. But the long queues of trucks at the land borders will remain. Austria is the main obstacle. Vienna fears an influx of migrants when all border controls disappear. And with elections due in Austria later this year, that position is unlikely to change soon.
Playing football for your country can be life-changing, but that's especially true for those playing in the Homeless World Cup. The tournament, which sees 70 countries take part, isn't just about competing for the trophy, it's about helping those struggling to find a home. Now an internationally recognised face is starring in a movie inspired by the competition and has been talking to our culture reporter Yasmin Rufo.
Bill Nighy, he's come down to a South London football pitch to give some friendly advice to some of the players who are hoping to be selected to represent England this year at the Homeless World Cup.
We have a fictional one, obviously, which was set in Rome. And you're allowed to laugh, I play the England coach. And it's basically me and a bunch of young nutters roaming about Rome.
This lot are England's best homeless players. Homeless.
I am a big football fan. My home team is Crystal Palace, but I love all football. The Champions League is the Holy Grail. The Champions League, when the music starts, I am at peace.
This competition brings us all together. A second chance to be part of the team.
You represent the potential that sport has to build a better world.
And they say it's a universal language, which it is for about half the world, including me. The power of football brings people from all parts of the world together in the same place and they have to combine and work together.
Sharing Nighy's love of football is Raf Aziz, who represented England in the 2018 Homeless World Cup tournament in Mexico.
Over a number of years, I had to experience homelessness in different ways. Eventually, it led me to jail a couple of times, and then I spent about 4 years living in a Salvation Army hostel. Football became my life, so after a handful of years, I had the good news that I was going to represent Team England, even though I'm French, and I went to Mexico in 2018. And there is clearly a before and after the World Cup.
You're about to represent your country, so officially supplied by the FA itself. When you put on this shirt, you're putting on the history of the beautiful game.
I came back full of confidence, so inspired to give back to the community that I became a charity worker. So I've been full cycle a couple of times since my homeless days, and it's all thanks to the Homeless World Cup.
I was a player. Billy Walker, legend in the making.
Raf's experiences are not too dissimilar to one of the film's cast members.
He's been living in his car for months. He's lost.
Top Boy actor Michael Ward was once homeless himself.
Me and my family have been homeless many times as well, and I haven't realised that because my mum has basically tried to cover it up. It's a global issue that definitely needs help tackling, and I'm glad that the Homeless World Cup does a little part of that.
Meeting some of the real Homeless World Cup players during filming has given Michael a new perspective on homelessness.
Don't judge a book by its cover. I'm guilty of that, but a lot of the time it's not their fault. And, you know, if someone had come in earlier and not judged or anything like that, it might have been able to help them.
And what's the point of the film? Well, for Bill Nye, there is only one takeaway.
If I had one wish for the film, is that audiences can see that homeless people aren't a species. They're individuals and they're people, they're human beings, and they have different stories, they come from different, and they're in that situation for different reasons, and they're not to be considered as some kind of tribe within the tribe, you know.
Everyone has a reason for being here, and every player has a story to tell. Are you ready?
Bill Nye ending that report by Yasmin Rufo. Still to come, one of the world's most wanted men has been found to be a prolific reviewer on Google. And
it's so hot. We stopped for a bit because otherwise the sun would kill us.
We join a police raid in Brazil investigating degrading working conditions in the Canuba wax industry.
The information spaces we inhabit can resemble a hall of mirrors.
It's called guided democracy or managed democracy. There are different parties, different candidates, but everyone knows who is going to win.
The Global Jigsaw is the podcast helping you make sense of them.
We've seen a crackdown on the opposition. We've seen an increase in censorship.
That's The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Supporters of India's main opposition alliance came out onto the streets of Delhi on Sunday ahead of next month's general election. They were protesting against the arrest of the capital's chief minister on corruption charges and say the governing BJP is targeting its political opponents to prevent them from campaigning for next month's election. Our South Asia regional editor Anbarasan Etharajan was at the rally.
Opposition supporters have gathered here and they are coming from Delhi and other neighbouring states near the capital city. And now they are calling for the release of Arvind Kejriwal, the Delhi chief minister. He was taken into custody 10 days ago on corruption charges, which he denies. Major leaders are addressing this rally, saying that India's democracy and constitution should be saved. And that is their motive of this major rally here. The Congress party says that its bank accounts have been frozen and they have been asked to pay more than $200 million in fine for allegedly violating tax rules. But the government denies any political motive behind that action, saying the law will take its own course. Now, India's elections are due to start on the 19th of April and it will be held in several phases. The campaign is going across the country, but what the opposition is saying is that there is no level playing field. For example, they accuse the Election Commission of being biased towards the governing BJP, and they say that investigative agencies are being used to cripple them, to stifle dissent, to prevent them from campaigning. However, the governing BJP denies these charges, and the mammoth exercise of India's general election, in which Prime Minister Narendra Modi is seeking a third straight term, is starting on the 19th of April.
Anbarasan Etharajan in Delhi. Over the weekend, as on many previous days, Ukraine suffered a series of airstrikes from Russia targeting military and energy infrastructure. It's another blow to a nation now on the defensive. Running out of weapons and ammunition, its skies increasingly dominated by Russian aircraft, missiles and drones. Ukrainian land forces have been pushed back by Russian attacks as well. And cities close to the front line, like Kharkiv in the northeast, once again fear a Russian advance. Sarah Rainsford reports.
This is what it looks like when Russia tries to take a Ukrainian city. I'm standing on a housing estate on the edge of Kharkiv, and it is a complete mess. There are giant multi-story blocks of flats all around me. Shrapnel damage all up the side of this one. There are massive chunks blown out of some of these buildings. Russia tried extremely hard to take Kharkiv right at the beginning of the full-scale invasion. I'm talking to people here. The worry is that it's planning to try that again. I just checked my phone and according to the app I have here, it shows that there is an air alert right now. Immediately proceed to the nearest shelter, it says. I'm just looking around. Nobody's taking any notice of that. Can I sit here? Is that okay? Just the microphone?
Sit.
Thank you.
Sure.
There's an air raid alert now, but you're still sitting on the bench. Is that normal?
Yeah, it's like habit already. Yeah, we sit there on the bench to speak with my friend.
Can I ask you, lots of people are talking about the fact that they're worried that the Russians might come back again. Does that worry you?
Yeah, it's worry us. With my friends, we speak about it. Yeah, it's really scary. We're afraid.
Europe now, you feel more nervous about that?
Yeah, we know what about it, about the situation that it will happen, because they got new weapons. It's like scary as a little.
What the? This BBC is Anglia. Вы по-английски не разговариваете? There's lots of talk about these missile attacks and also the worry about Russian forces coming and trying to take Kharkiv again. Are you worried?
Я сама з Луганської області. Тому для мене
Наталя herself is from Luhansk region. Now she lives here and her husband is fighting in the army. She's not going anywhere. She wants to stay closer to her family. She says that the same kind of mood is among the team. They're trying to spread this mood to their clients as well. They believe that Ukraine will win. So,
Natalia was just telling me that lots of people in Kharkiv grew up speaking Russian, and ever since the full-scale invasion, there's been this very obvious switch away from Russian, and clearly that's a political decision, and it's a sign of people's allegiances here. They don't want to be part of Russia at all.
Our correspondent Sarah Rainsford. One of the world's most wanted men, who you'd think would want to keep a low profile, has been leaving Google reviews on the internet. Reports from the website Bellingcat and the Sunday Times newspaper here in the UK say Christy Kinahan, an Irish gangster, has been writing hundreds of reviews of restaurants, hotels and events, giving investigators a rare insight into his psychology and movements. Mr. Kinahan, who uses the alias Christopher Vincent, lives in Dubai with his two sons, having left Ireland in 2016. That followed a bitter feud with a rival gang in which 18 people were murdered. John Mooney is an investigative journalist and host of the Dark State podcast. He told Owen Bennett-Jones more about Christy Kinahan.
Well, Christy Kinahan is the leader of a transnational organised crime group that is reputed to be one of the most powerful in the world. Indeed, its tentacles stretch right across the globe. So it is responsible for much of the cocaine trade in Europe, but it is also involved in money laundering activities. It has connections into hostile states like Russia and Venezuela and Iran. So the organisation itself is reputed to have a fortune of 1.5 billion at this stage. So it is one of the world's premier criminal organisations.
And all of those very serious allegations have gone through courts and led to convictions, right?
Christy Kinahan is a convicted drugs trafficker. His first conviction occurred in the 80s and he served a significant prison sentence for heroin dealing. He has subsequently been arrested on numerous occasions and indeed has served more prison sentences in Ireland and Belgium. So he is quite a serious criminal who has spent a considerable amount of time in prison. But he is unusual insofar as that he put his time in prison to good use, and indeed he studied for various degrees whilst inside and also became proficient in various languages and is now actually a multilingual man.
Right. And so far has this, avoided extradition. So I guess the point is that a man in this situation, you would think, would be keeping a very low profile. So it is surprising that he is doing lots of reviews online under a rather sort of flimsy fake name.
The Sunday Times and Bellingcat, our partners on this project, began investigating what looked like Google reviews that were being posted by an account which we believed was Christy Kinahan some 6 months ago. And we quickly established that indeed it was him. And contrary to the public's impression of him as a man who would be uber cautious, very security aware, it appeared that in his spare time, he literally could not stop posting reviews about everything from his local supermarket to COVID testing centres to, at one stage, he even reviewed a Waitrose. And what we did was we traced all of these reviews and built up a very detailed picture of his travel, various locations at various times. But we were also able to connect him to various meetings in different parts of the world. He's someone that it appears to me that when he is idle, he just simply reviews and posts these things. And he comes across as a man who's very concerned about service. He likes value for money. He's very impatient. He is just someone who appears almost to be very grouchy, very argumentative behind the scenes. And he's just one of the, I suppose, what most people might call an awkward customer.
A bit grumpy. Well, the other aspect of these reviews that's so amazing is sometimes he takes pictures, and highly incompetent in the sense that he ends up filming himself in the sort of reflection of windows and that kind of thing. Again, helping law enforcement work out where he is. Although maybe law enforcement know perfectly well where he is, and it's just a question of getting the UAE to extradite him, is it?
I think both of statements are correct. Kinnan thought he was being careful about the photographs and images he took. So he would take, for example, an image of a hotel lobby. But when you're using a camera phone, he would often miss his own reflection being caught in a mirror or something like that. The best way of maybe thinking about this is to hold a contradictory view of it. Whilst he is a very proficient criminal and he is very security conscious, he also simply does not understand modern technology. If you post dozens of reviews on Google Maps and if you upload lots of pictures, you are going to give away digital crumbs, should I say, to trace your movements.
Journalist John Mooney. Kanuba Wax is a product you may not have heard of, but you've almost certainly consumed it. It's added to sweets to stop them from melting, to pills to make them easier to swallow, and it's used as a thickener in lipstick and mascara. Harvesting the wax from palm trees in Brazil is an industry in which, according to the authorities, companies are failing to improve working conditions. Last year, more than 3,000 workers across all industries were rescued from situations including forced labour and degrading work conditions. Our correspondent Katie Watson was given exclusive access to a raid with the federal police in northeastern Brazil.
We're heading to a farm where authorities suspect workers are being exploited. They want to catch the culprits red-handed. This hot and dry terrain is unforgiving. Piauí is one of the poorest parts of Brazil. It's home to the spiky Carnauba palm tree, and cutting down its leaves and harvesting the wax provides a livelihood to hundreds of thousands of people. We find workers sheltering from the midday sun. Who's in charge here? The lead investigator asks. One by one, the men are interviewed. The boss, nowhere to be seen. Irismar Pereira is one of the unregistered workers.
It's so hot. We stop for a bit because otherwise the sand would kill us.
Lunch arrives, rice and chicken feet. People here are famished. Carnauba harvesting is difficult work. The rough palm trees can cut their hands. The heat is exhausting.
The authorities are asking the workers here to carry out their daily jobs just to see how they do it, how safely they do it, just get a fuller picture of their day-to-day activities.
The men have very little training as they direct a long bamboo pole with a scythe at the end of it to chop down the heavy leaves. The leaves are then strapped onto donkeys to lead the men to a pile for the material to dry. In Brazil, working conditions that are degrading or risk workers' health can fall under the definition of modern-day slavery. Evidence of that is at the accommodation block too. Inspector Gislene Melo dos Santos Tacholski shows me more breaches of labour laws. The ceilings are so low, you have to duck to enter the main door. People sleeping in hammocks, itself not a problem, but there are holes in the roof and broken electricity sockets dangling from the ceiling. Boss Edmilson shows up and has been fined $30,000. This is the third time he's been caught breaking the rules. He's angry.
The government needs to give small producers like me more of a chance.
I have been fighting to survive for some time now. The costs of producing this wax are more than what I receive.
Jimmy Olsen wouldn't go on the record about who he sells to. This is very common, says Gislaini, and makes it impossible to trace from producer to buyer. In 2016, the state, concerned with the number of workers they were rescuing in difficult conditions, asked the top five biggest wax processing companies to sign an agreement committing themselves to improving the supply chain and ending this informality. The BBC was shown the client list of the region's biggest wax processor, Brasil Ceres. They include big companies like L'Oreal. According to prosecutors, producers found to have employed workers in conditions analogous to slave labour say they sold wax to Brasil Ceres even after the company said they'd improve the supply chain. But it's hard to prove because there isn't a paper trail. Brasil Ceres told the BBC that it only works with suppliers that can prove they comply with labour laws. L'Oreal says it too is committed to ethical sourcing and has implemented an audit programme with its suppliers to ensure due diligence. Investigator Gislaini, though, says despite those promises, nothing changes. In the 11 years she's been rescuing workers in this industry, the supply chain has consistently been impossible to trace.
There is what we call deliberate blindness. It's comfortable for the industry not to see the problems because they don't need to act, they don't need to pay.
It is, as so often is the case, an unequal power balance between producers on the ground and the financially powerful businesses far away. But in the Carnauba wax industry, many benefit from that divide.
Katie Watson reporting. Now, before we end this podcast, let's hear some of the Easter Day celebrations from around the world. In Jerusalem, worshippers attended Mass at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, believed by many to be the place where Jesus was crucified. And tens of thousands gathered in St. Peter's Square in Rome. Some of the sounds of Easter 2024. And that's all from us for now. There'll be a new edition of Global News to download later. If you'd like to comment on this podcast and the stories we included, drop us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk or on X, we are at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Callum McLean. The producer was Carl Josephs. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Andrew Peach. Thanks for listening. And until next time, goodbye.
The information spaces we inhabit can resemble a hall of mirrors.
It's called guided democracy or managed democracy. There are different parties, different candidates, but everyone knows who is going to win.
The Global Jigsaw is the podcast helping you make sense of them.
We've seen a crackdown on the opposition. We've seen an increase in censorship.
That's The Global Jigsaw from the BBC World Service. Listen now by searching for The Explanation wherever you get your BBC podcasts.